Hi, my name is Simon.
My name is Mbuyi.
And welcome back to Waking Up in South Africa, Mindfulness-Based Conversations podcast series. Today we are going to be tuning into the subject of being mindful of trauma. It's a subject that we've been planning to explore and speak about for many months. And it has a particular valence and immediacy and significance at this time, as we are in about day 41 of the lockdown here in South Africa. And of course, the lockdown is at various points around the globe. And we are incredibly fortunate and grateful to be in conversation, Mbuyi and myself, with Paula Ramirez, who is based in Colombia and is a good friend of mine and of Mbuyi's, and is a close friend of the community here in South Africa, having been a speaker at the conference at the Cradle of Humankind last year. So welcome, Paula.
Well, thank you so much, Simon and Mbuyi, for having me here today. Thank you for listening.
So Paula's got the most incredibly interesting and diverse background, and I'm going to invite her just to give us a little bit of a sense of that. But one of the primary reasons we felt it would be useful to get Paula's insights and inputs around trauma is because Paula has worked in areas around the world with very traumatized communities, with landmine survivors in Colombia, her native Colombia, working in South Sudan with refugees, working with Rohingya refugees, more latterly. She's part of a global nonprofit called Respira, which means breathe in Spanish, and is affiliated with the United Nations and does a lot of her mindfulness-based work around the world through the UN. So it brings a wealth of depth and experience. And I'd say what trumps all of that is Paula's incredible embodiment of presence and compassion, and her capacity to communicate clearly and succinctly what mindful it is while living it so deeply and fully in her own life. So Paula, it's amazing to be in conversation with you and stepping into that. I'm wondering if there's anything you'd like to begin with in terms of your own personal story around what brought you to mindfulness and how you landed up working in these very challenging and traumatic and traumatized environments with people across the globe.
Thank you so much, Simon, for your introduction and your words. Really appreciate it. And I feel like saying two things about why I ended up doing mindfulness. One is, having been born in a country with so much trauma, we have been under 50 years of armed conflict in Colombia. And when I was a child, one of the bombs of Pablo Escobar exploded nearby my place. And when that happened, I was seven. And I remember like looking at the news and then the blast, and nothing happened to my family. But I could feel that night that they could go at any moment, you know, that they could leave this earth, you know, that I was not going to half my parents, because there was something out there that was threatening life. And that something out there was armed conflict, was war. So that was very much integrated in my system when I was a child and growing up, in this feeling of being in a place where there was fear. So that's one side of it, of why I did mindfulness. The first thing that really connected me with awareness of something that was triggering life. And the other thing that happened to me is that when I was 18, I used to play the flute and I used to do theater and I wanted to study music. And when I was playing my flute, at some point, my hands, I was having all this pain in my hands and I couldn't move my joints. And I went to the doctor and the doctor said, well, you have an autoimmune illness and develop into lupus or into any other. But it's, yeah, there's something in your system. And he said, this is very interesting because you're very young. And he said, this is an illness that is you against yourself. And he said, you can do two things. You can take a lot of cortisol and bear with the downside effects of it, or you can go, sit, meditate, run marathons, do yoga, and put yourself together, basically. And he actually saved my life. And that combination of really trying to understand my own, the places where I was being hard on myself, all my rage, my fear, my anger that was making me ill, connected as well with the fact of having been born in a war-torn country, and the search for my own inner peace with my body and my own committed work towards peace building in my country, combined mindfulness and peace building.
It's a very powerful story. Thank you. Mbui?
Yeah. So, Paula, can you please tell us what, how you define trauma to people that you work with? So people who are not necessarily aware of the term trauma. So how would you define it to those people, especially the people that you work with in the mindfulness interventions that you facilitate or teach?
Thank you for that question, Bui. I think having to frame trauma, for example, when I work with the UN, for example, or IOM specifically, they don't necessarily use the word trauma in the interventions that they make. And they have a good reason for it, I think, and is that not everybody gets traumatized. So I, just because I work for the UN, I need to be very careful with the way in which I frame trauma. So the first thing that I would say is, in front of a situation, some of us can be traumatized and some of us don't. Yes, just to make that experience inclusive for different types of people. But then trauma is actually something that hits your nervous system. It hits your ability to be connected, to be present. Trauma is something that keeps you in a particular moment in space and time away from the present moment. It's like a disconnection. There is this beautiful image around trauma that is like snow falling over an ice place. So there's ice and there's snow falling. And there's no way to move forward. So it's like being trapped there, and that snow falling and no fluidity coming. That's one way in which I explain it at the individual level, but also because I work a lot with groups of people, with collectives, refugees, people that have been affected by armed conflicts, wars, genocide. There's also this naming of, and there's collective trauma. There's somehow disconnected us all from our roots, from our ritual passages. Human beings, we're made of symbols. We give symbols to our traditions, to culture. There are events that disconnect us from that. And in the logics of war, what one group targets against the other group is exactly that, the sense of belonging. You're not worth it. You are a cockroach. I take away your humanity. And in that sense, nothing that makes you feel that your identity matters, that your belonging matters, it's actually the target. That's a collective trauma.
So we're talking about both individual and collective, that the nervous system is affected, is central to it in a particular way, and that there's this quality of a disconnection, what we often call psychological dissociation or an absencing. We kind of fall away from ourselves, and especially we can fall away from our bodies, become disembodied, and we dissociate. Mm-hmm. It's interesting for me that, you know, we can, maybe it's difficult at the UN and they don't want to use that word, but trauma is a continuum, is it not? I mean, everybody's experienced some degree of trauma. So it's like, you know, one can have what's called small T traumas, where we separation as an infant and not enough repair from our parents, all the way to the far end of the continuum with like massive disasters or wars or physical, emotional, sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. So there's a long continuum. But what is interesting to me is maybe the degrees of intensity and is different along that continuum, but there are those common elements. One is that there's a dissociative quality or a disconnecting quality. Mm-hmm. And the other is that there's something about becoming disembodied. I know there's a famous book about trauma by Bessel van der Kolk based on his seminal article, The Body Keeps the Score. Mm-hmm. So I'd be very interested to hear in your experience about working with trauma, and whether it's your own trauma or individuals or in group settings with collective trauma, how does working with the body show up, and how are you bringing a mindfulness approach to that truth about trauma being the body keeps the score?
Mm-hmm. For that question, Simon, I think about trauma like something that stays in a moment of time where it is really stuck in our bodies. Yes. So let's say that we are scared of heights. Yes. And we know that we're safe. We know that we're going to be safe, that there's no problem if we just going to a tall stair or a place, yes, into a high space. But it's your body. You feel in your body that you can actually not move. You can feel the fear of going out to the street, and you know that you're safe, and you know that nothing's going to happen to you, and you can know that cognitively.
Mm.
Then the fear, where you feel that trap, it's actually in your body. You cannot breathe. You feel the tension. You feel the contraction of your system. And that is happening in your body. Yes? So that's why working trauma at the body level is so important. And mostly with people that have undergone violence and experience of war, when you get a trauma that has been perpetrated to you because of another human being, the connection, the trust towards other human beings, it's very much undermined. So it's like you know in that moment that you have a human being in front of you and there's something in you that cannot trust. So the importance of really coming back into that presencing, into that embodiment of yourself in the moment, slowly, slowly. It's very important actually to heal that trauma and allow the body to find space where? Here, in the present. Yes, but that takes a lot of time, mostly when what saved you in a given moment, in a moment that was difficult for you, was actually disconnecting from your body. So many of the sexual abuse survivors that I have worked with, well, a very important mechanism for them, and I want to validate that as something very intelligent of our structure, you know, is disconnecting. You know, I just go into freeze and I disconnect. And that's so intelligent of our system. That served us in that moment, in that space, and in that time. But if we keep taking that with us in our system, it's not going to support our human experience of being at ease with our bodies and at ease with other human beings. So it's like mindfulness allows us to slowly, slowly, with something that Levine would call the titration, which is small bits of awareness into, okay, if I've been disconnected from my body for so long, I can start feeling perhaps the touch of my feet against the floor right now. And then we come back. Yes, it's just a bit. But slowly, slowly, the embodiment can happen so that we can train it back.
Thank you. That's really, really helpful. And just to extend your question, Mbuyi, around you know, what is trauma and its relation to the immune system, there's a fascinating study, I'm sure it's been replicated, that looked at post-traumatic stress disorder, which is right at the extreme edge of the continuum of trauma. It's a diagnosed mm-hmm. disorder. And they did brain imaging studies, functional MRI, and they found that the hippocampus, which is a part of the brain in the limbic system, which is involved in the emotional context of memory, is shrunk. Mm-hmm. So it's as if kind of our it's like a ghost in the machine. We experience the past vividly in the present, and the past is extremely unpleasant. Unpleasant mm-hmm. in the present.
Yes. Yes.
And that ghost in the machine is actually not so much a ghost, it's actually changed the way our nervous system is actually processing information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. And makes us very reactive. One of the things that I have worked a lot with women, and I'm thinking mostly about women in South Sudan right now with their children, they would say, and this connects with your, like, why working trauma with the body? And is they used to say, I don't want my child to experience what I lived. But they were very violent with their children. That disconnection of themselves with their bodies, in them not feeling at ease with what and who they are, with their story of trauma in that moment, if they were not able to integrate that as part of their selves, they were very violent against their children as well. So in this war against myself, I don't want to feel this, I don't want to have that, I get stuck, I get frozen. And that creates so much tension and so much reactivity also towards the people that we love. So that creates in the collective trauma, the generation to generation trauma, that it's also part of this equation.
Okay. Yeah, I'm hearing you talk about that, and I can't help but think about how it must feel for that individual who has been through that trauma and how they feel when that memory that Simon is talking about that happens in the hippocampus, how uncomfortable it must feel to be in that body. Because from my personal trauma, I've noticed that this dissociation happens when I'm feeling in the body something that's uncomfortable. So my disconnection or dissociation is a way to avoid the discomfort. And looking at the definition of mindfulness by Jon Kabat-Zinn, which says mindfulness is paying attention to the present moment in a particular way, it makes me think that, okay, so with mindfulness, what we get is kindness or compassion, being able to be with this discomfort. Am I right in seeing it that way?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Mbuya, I think that you're bringing something very important, very core even of what we're talking about. And is in one side, normalizing that, of course, you don't want to be in your body, you know, like, of course, it's scary, of course, you know, and your system has this ability of disconnection. And it's there for a reason, to keep survival. That's amazing about trauma. And it's like understanding that, well, I did that because that was my way to staying alive. That's beautiful. But then what you're saying, it's very important, and is mindfulness bringing the attention. And again, slowly, slowly, bits and pieces, bringing the attention back into your experience. It's actually taking the attention back to your human experience, to who you are. And that happens with attention. But it's of no use to have attention if you are taking the stick out and hitting yourself because of what happened to you, because you're still feeling that way, because you hate to be in your body. It's of no use. Attention, only attention, doesn't do anything. There's the other part of it that you're mentioning, Mbuya, and is compassion, and is allowing myself to, okay, how can I integrate? Yeah, this compassion of I did what was right. I did what my system could do in that moment in order to stay alive. And now it's different. So maybe slowly, slowly, like orientation. Where are you right now? Who are the people that you're with? The space that you're practicing mindfulness in? know, slowly, slowly knowing that you're safe and that compassion is there to support you. It's very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, many of the people that I've worked with and spoken to kind of almost have a secondary trauma, which is the feeling of shame and the feeling that they're responsible for what happened. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, as you say, the stick element. It's like, so there's an awareness, okay, but then the stick comes out. And so the kind of beginning to cultivate not only this embodied awareness, but this the quality of kind of a benevolent attitude, drip by drip or drop by drop or moment by moment, feels absolutely fundamental and foundational to trauma healing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I wonder if we can, you know, how would that look then on a collective scale? If we're talking about individuals and individual nervous systems and individual experience, how does that look to you based on your experience of working with really traumatized groups of people around the world? How does that show up as a collective? What are the dynamics of collective trauma? And by extension, what are the dynamics of working skillfully in a healing way with collective trauma? What does that even mean, collective trauma?
Mm. Mm. But what I'm feeling is, as I was saying, collective trauma is something that at the collective level, something that happens to us at the collective level that disintegrate us, disintegrate our sense of belonging, identity. It's very much triggered. I can think about two things right now, two examples, and is one that is very present for me right now and is with grave diggers in South Sudan. I was working with these seven guys and they were burying bodies one after the other since 2013 after the war. And they had to bury so much bodies daily that they disconnected from their rituals. Rituals are a very important aspect of us as a collective, mostly when it's around death. Every culture has its own rites of passage around death. And these guys, collectively, they were disconnected from that rites of passage because they were just like one body, the other, one body, the other, and they had all this trauma. And then working with them meant how mindfulness practice could not only bring the awareness of attention to their experience of having buried so many bodies, one after the other, but also what mindfulness practice brought at the collective level is, how is it that we used to bury our bodies before? What were the cultural elements that were present? And one of our sessions was around Gadkwaf, which is their god. And bringing Gadkwaf back and making rituals for them to be able to make a rite of passage to every body, to every human life that they had buried in the ground. So we went into collectively making some rites of passage around death and around what that meant for us at individual level, but as the collective. So that's one thing that I'm thinking, and I'm also thinking about the political use of language. So for example, to give you an example of working with landmine survivors in Colombia, there's this amount of guilt of people when they stepped into a landmine. So there's a lot of this guilt of, I stepped into it. I took this thing that was on the ground and I took it and then exploded in my hands and now I don't have hands and I can't see. It was my fault. And usually in literature or at the poetic level, we used to call it an accident, a landmine accident. And it is not. It's a landmine attack. Even if it happened after the massacre of that town 3 years ago, but the landmine was there, it is still an attack. It's like this language around people knowing that, whoa, wait, it's not an accident. You were attacked. So that at the collective level, also the use of language and how we frame the dynamics and the logics of war, it's very important.
Thanks for that, Paula. And when you talk about the collective in countries that still are going through wars, it makes me think about what we are going through as a collective, what's going on in the world right now. Mm-hmm. Something that we can all relate to in the sense that each and every country at the moment, like, is going through the COVID-19 outbreak. So how do you think that can come up? Like, how do you think this trauma is coming up in the collective, in the world right now? And mm-hmm. also, how can we use mindfulness right now at this moment, instead of maybe being reactive and only thinking about it later? So how can we use mindfulness right now as a collective?
It's a great question, Mbuya. Out of the groups that I'm working with since COVID-19, I have been working with humanitarian workers in Bangladesh, in Nigeria, in South Sudan, Colombia. And what I'm seeing is things at two levels. And the fact of being confined, like, confinement is very hard for people. So just like this feeling of being trapped can really trigger our nervous system, because we feel that there's a threat. So we activate, we go into this mode of reactivity. So that's hard, you know, and that can be traumatizing for many individuals. And also that reactivity mode can bring a lot of trauma into households. So what I'm seeing a lot right now is the amount of domestic violence that is alive, that is there, as part of the experience of living COVID-19, and also in the larger system. And then again, talking about our rites of passage, like the amount of people that have died without their loved ones, like, being able to see them, you know, and without being able to, you know, to make a proper rite of passage, like, that has a huge impact in our system, mostly in a world or in places where we feel that we're safe, that we got these kind of things. Like, I'm thinking about Spain, a country that, like, it's very hard. And what I'm feeling right now is mindfulness can bring something, can bring things in a number of levels. And is this awareness that we live in one same world.
Huh.
I feel that as in no other moment in the world have we felt so close to each other in terms of what is happening to us. And I have groups, again, like in Nigeria, and I have groups of people in Spain. And it's like we are walking to a very similar moment, you know, in terms of uncertainty, dealing with it. So just knowing that we're part of this earth together and that we are connected. And that we are responsible, that we are responsible for ourselves, but for each other. All the questions that many people are asking around, how is it that we're eating? You know, livestock farming, like, there are many that are out there, you know, that people, so that's a way that of being mindful of, okay, what is this telling us, you know? And being able to walk that in dignity, in this shared common humanity. What is beautiful about mindfulness and working mindfulness in groups is that, oh, well, when that person is talking about him or herself, but it's talking as well about me. You know, when we go into group sessions of mindfulness, mindfulness is not about the breath. Mindfulness is about who we are and how we engage in life and the real experience of who you are. And that is so healing in group sessions. Imagine right now having that possibility at the human scale of being responsible for all of us. Like, what happened in China has an impact in all of us, you know, and it belongs to all of us as humanity. It's not a Chinese thing. It's us. So there's that on that aspect. And then on the other side of it, oh, it's amazing the amount of mindfulness out there available now. Mindfulness and yoga is like if stopping has allowed people to, okay, let me come to myself and let me have tools, because many people are saying, well, I have actually never stopped. I've been doing and doing and doing and doing and doing and doing, and now I have to stop. Ugh, how do I do that? So that's also something that mindfulness can bring, that it's the tools for people to stop and ask the right questions about themselves and who they are.
Yeah, that's very evocative and resonant. Thank you. One of the questions that comes up as you're speaking is the kind of narrative that we use around COVID-19 is very much a war narrative. Like the war on terror and the war on the virus, and there's very much a war metaphor. And it's interesting because you've grown up in a war zone. I think South Africa, we could say Mbuyi was a war zone in very many respects, and different from Colombia. And you've been inside and seen the consequences of war and war zones. And we tend to deploy and employ the kind of language of war. And so we go to war with the virus, and we tend to go to war with each other about who's right, whose opinion is right, and which conspiracy theory is right. And everybody seems to be in battle with each other. And so what is interesting is how this is a twofold question, and then there's a third element, which is how can the practice and the kind of real deep qualities that you're referring to about mindfulness is, and awareness is who I am and who we are, what kind of narrative can that, is that a different narrative? What is the base, the foundation of that kind of speaking with each other and with ourselves? So that's the one question. Can we deploy a different way of speaking about what is happening in these times? And then maybe if you could naturally lead, because it feels like there's a natural leading into maybe just offering us a short collective mindfulness guiding practice. So whoever is listening, then wherever you are and whatever point you're listening, we all can be practicing together, and it can just be a couple of minutes. So if you could speak to that, can we change the language? Not making it about language, it's still about mindfulness in relation to the pandemic and the traumatization of being in lockdown and of having the ground swept out of under our feet of familiarity, of economic uncertainty, of social and physical distancing and illness and uncertainty. How can mindfulness as a practice, but also as an ethos, as an ethic, as an essence, help us to reframe the way we speak about this, and then can we practice together?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for that, Simon. Thanks for the invitation as well to lead the practice. I would love that. Yeah. What I'm feeling is the habit of the mind. We have been, what we practice grow, right? What we practice in our habit, that's what's going to grow. And it's perfectly natural. I feel that we, in our distress, we try to find something out there to blame. That's what we have been used to. And mindfulness actually works on that. Mindfulness is like, oh, okay, let us see our habits in terms of that language, or who is the enemy. But then if we look outside, who is the enemy? Well, there's no enemy that we can pinpoint. And it's more how the narrative of COVID-19 can be, what is it that this moment is asking from me? What is alive in my experience as a human being in 2020, living this very particular moment in the world? Not in terms of who is to blame, because there's no one to blame if we look at it. And it's like, okay, I cannot do anything from that outside. There's nothing out there that I'm going to fight that is going to make me feel better in quarantine. So it's like, what is this moment, 2020, a historical moment in humanity? What is this saying about me? And what's very interesting as well is that that question allows us to frame ourselves in the present, but also there are many things as we are stopping. There are many things from the past that may arise as well, things that we have not seen. So it's really that narrative of, oh, let me focus, you know, the focus is outside. Who is to blame? To, okay, what is this asking from me? So that's what I'm feeling, Simon. I don't know if you resonate with that or if you have any other idea around that narrative or in Buyi before we could jump into practice.
Paula, as you are talking about that, I'm just reflecting on my patterns of jumping to blaming, looking for these conspiracy theories. Like, I noticed that with me, it's when there is no awareness, there's no mindfulness of what's happening inside of me right now. So it's when I'm not able to sit with the not knowing or with uncertainty. So it's an uncomfortable feeling. With mindfulness, I'm able to notice it and be with it at this moment. And then it passes through. It's replaced by spaciousness that I was talking about earlier when we were checking in. And from that spaciousness, I'm able to be in this moment. But if I don't notice that discomfort, then I find myself on Twitter. I find myself looking for explanations for what is happening, trying to do away with the not knowing what the uncertainty and discomfort that's here right now. So mindfulness is this tool that I can use to be with what's happening right now, this discomfort that's arising and coming up right now.
What comes up for me is an amazing insight from Carl Jung. He said, he's a Swiss psychoanalyst, and he said, what if in the end I should discover that I myself am the enemy? Who must be loved? Who must be loved? What then? And it's just landing those words as you both speaking, that feels like an invitation, which is inherent to mindfulness, which is come back into relationship. And you were speaking, Paula, right at the beginning of our conversation about trauma being a disconnection, a dehumanizing, a failure to see other, and then this ongoing effect through ongoing trauma or the effects of trauma of kind of a loss of presencing and of who we are, in the sense we forget who we are. I forget who I am. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense of restoration and re-inhabiting of the relational field, the interrelationships or interconnections, as people are talking about, as a different kind of narrative. And you know, we all three of us were fortunate to be at the mindfulness conference last year, where Baba Mandaza, I'm sure you remember that closing session, and he offered a blessing to all the people in the room. There was a lot of trauma in the room as it happened. And the thing that stood out for me is that he introduced a different narrative. And he said, be like the ocean that refuses no river. Be like the ocean that refuses no river. And so when we get a metaphor of an ocean refusing no river, it's another narrative which is much closer to what mindfulness, presencing, awareness, and compassion, love, really is. And reestablishes our collective humanity and the honoring of our own and each other's experience. So I wonder if, Paula, you'd be gracious enough to kind of synthesize and drop into your own experience and what is moving through you as a way of guiding us in a brief practice, which is trauma sensitive.
Yeah, thank you, Simon and Buyi. I just want to name how when you say be as the ocean that refuses no river, I connect to Buyi's words around complexity, how it's very complex sometimes to allow a river to come. Like we resist because it's too much. It can be very heavily loaded. So mindfulness and the possibility of using it with titration a little bit can allow us to stay with that complexity to the extent that we can. It's not that suddenly we're going to be able to be as an ocean that welcomes all rivers. That may be too much to ask. So it's like in trauma-sensitive work, that's beautiful and it's so hard. So yeah, I'm feeling in this moment, if we can just go into ourselves, if possible, if we need to change our posture or perhaps not, allowing yourself to feel what's more useful for you right now, if it's again changing posture or not, to going to a very brief mindfulness practice. Once you have checked your posture, just noticing if you want to close your eyes or you want to leave them slightly open. In this moment, you can connect with the place that you're in the world right now. If you're listening to this podcast in South Africa, where is it that you're listening? Me being here in Colombia. How is it that we can place ourselves in the space and time right now? And how do I know that I am occupying the space that I have in the world in this particular moment? Maybe it's the awareness of our feet touching the floor, or maybe our buttock touching the surface that we're sitting in or that we're laying down in if we decided to lay down, for example. And if possible, feeling the whole structure of our spine, our head. And just noticing what in this moment allows me to feel present. Maybe it's this guidance of this body, or maybe if there's a sound out there that allows you to be more present. Or maybe it's nothing that I have mentioned, but maybe it's a texture. Maybe it's the texture of your clothes against your hand, for example. What is your anchor to the here and now? When there is nothing to do, nowhere to go, and perhaps giving room to what this experience of COVID-19 has meant for you. And maybe allowing yourself to ask that question of, what is this moment in humanity asking from me? This turning in of the narrative, like, what is it that this is saying about me? What are the questions that I want to ask? If possible, and they may not be answered right away, maybe just allowing those questions to come into feelings. Holding very closely that anchor of attention that helps you. Be here. Know that you're here with us listening to this podcast. So you can be with the present moment experience. Maybe allowing that question sink in. What is this moment asking from you? What is important? What do you want to take care of? I'm just giving a few seconds to breathe together in silence, to breathe or to feel our body or to listen to sounds. Whatever is more comfortable for you to be here in the present. But together, taking gently our mind to the present in a few seconds of silence. Yeah, slowly, checking. Yeah, have this as we finish the practice, if you need any movement, maybe in your body, if there's any movement that can support transitioning back to continuing this talk that we're involved in through this podcast.
Thank you. Well, the continuity of the podcast will be the next podcast because we've unfortunately run out of time. The time has gone very quickly. And so just to thank you, Paola, for bringing yourself and so wholeheartedly into our conversation and for bringing yourself so wholeheartedly in the work that you do in the world and for your insight.
Thank you, Simon and Mbuyi, for facilitating this space for us today.
Mbuyi, any last words before I sign off?
I just want to express my gratitude to Paola. And thank you, Paola. It's always a pleasure to have you in this space. And Simon, thanks as well.
So on behalf of the Institute for Mindfulness, the sponsor of this podcast series, we're grateful for your listening. And we hope this series continues to be of value. Please subscribe on the platform that you prefer for your podcasts and share it with your friends and family or anybody you feel might be interested. Until the next time we meet, be well and take care of your precious selves and all those around you.